Welcome to The Wheel, a Collegium Institute podcast, hosted by Collegium student fellows together with senior members of our team. This podcast features interviews with visiting scholars and faculty authors of new work that help us to appreciate the shape of life today, both in its dynamism and in its timelessness. Here we approach the mysteries of reality with wonder, exploring from a wide variety of disciplinary angles, all of which revolve around a core commitment to the unity of truth. Here, authors make the case for how and why their books are important, not just for specialists in their own field, but for all of us inside the university and out who seek wisdom for a life well lived.
My name is Rachel Fisher.
And I'm Sophia Silva.
And we will be leading our conversation with Katie Curl today, the former editor of Dappled Things magazine, a Collegium imprint, who is spearheading a new literary imprint with Bishop Barron's Word on Fire project. Sophia and I are both undergraduate students at the University of Pennsylvania and fellows of the Collegium Institute. Last spring, we participated in the Ars Vivendi Arts Fellowship, where we explored the heart of craft, beauty, and making with an attunement to their philosophical and theological underpinnings.
So we have a few questions for you, Katie, and we want to just first start off with telling if you could tell us a little bit about your career, your work with maybe Dappled Things, Collegium, and The Word on Fire.
Sure. So I started as editor on the Dappled Things board in 2007. I had two tenures as editor-in-chief, first from 2007 to 2011, then again from 2017 up until this year. So I also am a fiction writer. I have two books out of fiction, a novel, As Earth Without Water, and a short story collection, Fragile Objects, both with Wise Blood Books. Both of these are engaged in the practice of an idea that was first, I guess, articulated or acknowledged by my professor, Dr. Joshua Wren, the aesthetic of contemplative realism, which is a theological aesthetic, meaning that it is seeking to find some integration between the practice of literary realism, especially as it's developed over the last 150 years, with the vertical orientation of the theological, and to do this without resorting to a great deal of abstraction, but instead to embody, instantiate, incarnate what it means to live in a horizontal world with a vertical consciousness. So to go on from there, I recently came on board at Word on Fire to found a literary imprint, which we are calling Luminor. Luminor for the idea of being a luminary to the culture, as well as for the imagery that that brings of light and beauty. The imprint logo that we've just established is a beautiful little pine cone, and the pine cone is a symbol in East Asian cultures of resilience, it being a species in the ecosystem that releases its seeds and grows new stands of growth only in the harshest, most unpropitious conditions. You know, it's after wildfires that a pine cone will open to the wind, release its seeds, and in the conditions created by the wildfire, establish a new luxurious stand of growth. So there's an obvious metaphor there, kind of rooted in the situation of contemporary Christian writers who, after so many fires, are seeking to reestablish and regenerate what seems to have been lost, but perhaps is only dormant.
Mm, oh, absolutely. And how long ago did you join the Luminaire?
So Luminaire began very, very recently. I think by the time this podcast posts, we will have only been live for a few months. We did sort of a soft launch at the recent Catholic Imagination Conference in Notre Dame, which was overlapped with the DeNicholas Center for Ethics and Culture Conference in 2024. That's sort of our initial announcement of, you know, the fact that we exist. And now we are seeking to develop novels that are going to illuminate the Catholic vision of life for any serious reader, whether they themselves are a person of faith or perhaps not. So that's where we are as of this recording. We're getting ready to announce a short story contest, which will be possible to enter by going to our website, wordonfire.com/luminor. And it's sort of at the beginning. Our first releases will come out in 2026. So people can be looking at our webpage, waiting for the new releases to start posting. And we'll be ready to announce those sort of mid-year 2025 is the timeline we're on.
That's awesome. And how did you end up in this role with, in this new role?
So, I mean, it's a story of, as everything is, divine providence. I just happened to be invited into a conversation about where, you know, what role literature might play in continuing to communicate and articulate in a serious way what it means to be Catholic. And I think really the story then has to start back with at the very beginning with my involvement in Dappled Things. You know, I sort of took many years where I was only working as an associate editor at Dappled Things. I think what I'm trying to tell you is that it seemed fairly unlikely at a certain stage in my life that I would be coming back to, you know, to the practice of a literary life in such a serious way. I took a long hiatus where I was just home with young children and, in fact, homeschooling. So that stage has now come to a beautiful close. All my older, you know, my children are older now and in school. And, you know, it's so over the past 5 years, and I think beginning with the 2019 Catholic Imagination Conference, I've been trying in a more serious way to, you know, bring attention to these questions, sort of expand them, give them a reach beyond just a sort of circle of Catholics talking to each other and themselves, and, you know, maybe try to reach out into the wider culture, which is always something that Dappled Things wanted to do. We always wanted to produce a journal that would be appealing to anyone who picked it up, regardless of their particular relationship vis-a-vis the Catholic tradition. This is a very similar ambition that we have at Luminor, is to produce books that are going to be appealing and are going to be sort of trustworthy and going to be aesthetically beautiful, right? And communicate in a way that is deeply connected to what's really real, right? So I guess I've for a long time been involved in conversations about what that means and what it looks like. And this work, I think, now that I'm doing with Luminor is just a continuation of those long conversations in a very real way.
So. That's wonderful. I love that with the imagery that you were mentioning about the pine cone as well, with the flame and the heat, that it's like spreading the word in that way. So that's awesome. I guess next we were just interested about what inspired you growing up to take this career path. What kind of questions did you find yourself asking?
So I always knew I wanted to be a writer. That began very early for me. I was a reader very early. I was, as many writers are, kind of a strange and lonely child who hung out with books a lot. So that is a comforting relationship from the very beginning. For me as a young woman, maybe leaving high school, beginning college, I had a lot of very urgent questions about whether it was possible to be a literary artist and a serious Catholic, or what might be some of the problems you would encounter, some of the tensions that you would have to inhabit. I had the good luck of discovering Flannery O'Connor's The Habit of Being as a sophomore in college, which let me know that not only was I not alone, somebody had walked this path ahead of me. I think that's the experience that a lot of young writers have discovering O'Connor, especially young Catholic writers have discovering O'Connor for the first time. So not alone in that by any means, but that was the pathway. And for me, other writers who were important, Sigrid Undset, Henry James, Francois Mauriac, Mauriac in particular, as one who really wrestled with these questions of how can I enter into the depth of what it means to be an embodied creature in a way that's not complicit with concupiscence, that's not dragging my reader down into sort of a morass of complications that might lead them to sin, and that would be disastrous for me and for them spiritually if I were to do that. So how do I avoid doing that and at the same time, honor the richness and the beauty and the reality of what it means to be an embodied creature, right? This is by no means easy because the fiction writer, in order to to work well, has to be deeply concerned with what it means to be incarnate, right? We have to have a sort of relationship to the question of matter and form, right? That makes and that doesn't have to be extremely detailed in how we draw that out. But on the other hand, we might need to have this recourse to that that theological and philosophical language in order to understand how we do this without complicity with sin. Jacques Maritain talks about, you can depict anything as a Catholic writer in his treatise Art and Scholasticism. You can depict anything, but the question then becomes, from what altitude do you depict something, right? And from what vantage and with what, with what graces in your particular call to engage these questions. So somebody who has written, for example, about abuse in the church, although it's not something that I myself have endured, I did quite a bit of research to try to understand what that experience would be and how it, is an inversion of what the relationships between spiritual leaders and their people should be. That is obvious that that would be an urgent question for somebody with those kinds of concerns. So, right, and also sort of the question that comes up for a lot of my characters is how do you establish trust in reality? How do you reestablish trust in the goodness of existence after difficult experiences? That's not limited to, for example, an engagement with the abuse crisis. I think that's something that comes up for characters and as it does for individuals whenever you've been put through something that's difficult or something that's traumatic. So that is a long answer to your question of how did I get into this? Right? I got into this by way of a Catholic childhood, a reading childhood, and a desire to engage seriously in a literary mode with the questions that are urgent for our time.
That's awesome. And no, that is so cool to see how you've engaged with, like, especially very prevalent questions over the past very many years, that kind of integrating in those into your life as you grow up as a Catholic and then also then grow into adulthood. I guess you did mention that you had homeschooled, and I'm curious to know, I do kind of hope maybe that as an idea later on in my life, how have you integrated some of these ideas that you're talking about into that, or even just other ideas from your work into how you homeschooled and the kind of things that you would like to share with your children?
Sure. I think for this question, you would do better to talk to my colleague, Haley Stewart, who has also had a similar experience. And for me, I actually found it somewhat difficult, in part because the themes that I'm focused on are often things that you would want to keep out of a child's life. In my art, I'm thinking about things that you can really only come to terms with, I think, as an adult from an adult perspective. I think dealing with suffering from a child's perspective is different. These are deeply mysterious things that I haven't really even resolved how I think about myself. The votive imprint at Word on Fire is dealing with presenting the good, true, and beautiful to our children in a way that is very very much forward with the Right, with the light and bright and beautiful aspects. I think when I'm talking about, as I am talking about integrating my own personal preoccupation with the challenge and difficulty of this world with the word on fire ethos of leading with beauty, I am often necessarily engaged in a kind of wrestling with the question of the problem of evil in a way that I think you don't with children, right? Because they're just not developmentally prepared for that. So where's the sort of overlap between like my literary preoccupations and the fact that I was homeschooling? I think for me, the drive or desire to homeschool was it's complicated. Maybe I don't want to get too deeply into it, but the question for me was how do I protect, how do I shelter, right? How do I make sure that, right, we're walking very carefully and you know, not presenting things, you know, presenting things in a way that's developmentally appropriate. So you know, I think it became clear to me at a certain point in my discernment that if I were able to partner with a good Catholic school, the Catholic school would be better at doing that than I was personally. So I guess I'm telling you how I discerned out of homeschooling, but as a lead into reasons why somebody might, I think it's a question of particular circumstance. You know, in your circumstances, can you provide the kind of, you know, not just negative formation, because I think I was more concerned than I ought to have been about negative formation, but can you provide the kind of positive formation that the child needs? Can you do it in a way that is, you know, can you do it in a way that you feel called to put something into this situation? You have something to give that you feel can't quite be given in any other way. So I think it ties deeply into the mystery of your personal vocation. And I can say in sort of a broad general way, there was a time in my formation when, you know, in my vocation, when that was the case. I felt I had something to give, something to present, maybe something to do with paying attention, something to do with how we attend to the detail of the world, how we slow down and look at it. So there was a poetic aspect to it in the beginning. And then I think we just reached a stage of family life where the different developmental stages and the different demands and needs were overwhelming and were not being met well because, you know, that kind of slowing down, paying close attention the way that you do with a toddler. I got very into Montessori theory at a certain point. So I really enjoyed those early years of, you know, sitting with a child as they complete the simplest tasks, right? This is something that many parents struggle with, of course, because adult life is so fast-paced and so demanding and so complex, right? There's something about slowing down with a child like that that's very difficult that I found very appealing and moving and necessary, and that did flow deeply into the way that I try to pay attention to the world as a writer. So that stage was where it was working. And then we reached the later stage where that kind of close attention was being swallowed up in the, you know, complexity and difficulty of meeting many developmental needs at many different stages of life. I feel that I'm repeating myself, but perhaps you're following where I'm going with this, that it became a question of who is best suited to meet this need. And it became pretty clear that it wasn't me. Like I had other things to give and other ways to give them. So, right. That's kind of how we came to our decisions. But I want to say that, it's highly individual. It's by family, it's by child, it's by year, this decision.
That is so interesting. And I love the way that you put it, because I often do hear it from that negative side of, oh, trying to protect your child from all of the honestly horrible things that are out there in the world. Mm-hmm. And so I've always thought about it as sort of a preventative measure instead of something that's reaching within yourself and trying to find that thing that God might be calling you to give to this child at a certain time. And that's beautiful to hear that as a something that can evolve throughout the years and of what they might need at certain stages. And I really did like how you were talking about that kind of focus on just being able to do simple tasks and slow down your life. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of this program that Rachel and I were in last year, the Arts Vivendi. The leader of our session had us just go outside onto the lawn that's near Newman Center, mm-hmm. and legitimately just lay there and look up at the buildings and at the sky for like an hour. We were just out there and exactly. just really seeing what was around us and from different angles that we've never looked at before. And I thought it was such a cool experience and kind of something that throughout the days to come after that, and honestly throughout the year since then, I just kind of, whenever I'm sitting in a spot, it reminds me to actually just take in what's around me and be able to really slow down in that. Yeah,
exactly. That's beautiful. I love that. That reminds me of something that my AP English teacher did with us in our mm-hmm. junior year of high school. She had us read Emerson's essay, the name of this is escaping me, but you know the one. It's the one where he talks about being in nature and being in nature as this observer, right, as this transparent eyeball. And so she took us out into the football field of all places, and she had us kind of sit at a distance from one another so that there would be no shenanigans. And then she said, now you are a transparent eyeball. You're going to be here, and you're going to be with this experience of just existing in the natural world as long as you can. And I remember it very vividly, because it was fall, right? And fall in the South is not very spectacular the way it is up where you guys are, but it was this beautiful golden sort of tangle of underbrush that we were just, you know, in this brown grass, right, stretching to that horizon, and this creek, right? And I just remember sitting there and thinking, like, yes, there's something deeply connatural about this site. And if I can, you know, think of how can I find a life that lets me be a transparent eyeball more often.
That's awesome. Yeah. I often notice myself doing that too, because I feel like a lot of the times a value that is so often lost in our culture is just sitting in silence and just noticing. And I think the art of noticing is very key in the literary process. I like writing poetry myself, and that's really like the crux of it, is to just notice what's around you and to write about it. So mm-hmm. I think that's a great way to put it, that eyeball energy.
And yeah. I think that speaks to something that both of you raised about what is the value of literature for the contemporary world. It's not one more thing to add to your to-do list. It's not one more thing to carry as a burden that you feel you should be engaging or should be understanding. It's actually an aid to not just understanding intellectually, but it's an aid to a certain disposition, a certain way of being in the world that's receptive, that's contemplative, that's you know, closely attentive to things as they are, as to borrow a phrase from John Henry Newman, and not as we would have them be. Right. And another thing that he says about this in The Idea of a University is that it's not the way to learn to swim in difficult waters, never to have gone into them. Right. So Luminor, mm-hmm. as a literary imprint, we're focused on the contemporary. Mm-hmm. We're also focused on trying to bring some books from recent history back into print. So Word on Fire also has a classics line, which is bringing great books back into print. And bringing the titles that everybody already is maybe aware that they should be engaging, that from the great tradition, from the history of Catholic intellectual thought, right, and practice, as well as from maybe the ancient world, and thinking about those connections might be a way into the question of what it means to talk about Catholic literature as global, right? I think the great books are global in a way that maybe gets missed or misrepresented in conversations about the classics sometimes, right? But to get back to Luminor is looking to focus primarily on contemporary literature, and for precisely this reason, that it's very easy to lose sight in the buzz and hustle of contemporary life, of the fact that the greatest realities are always present to us, right? That's, you know, the good, true, and beautiful. God is emanating all of this all of the time, and it is precisely in our embodied life and in our circumstances that he's constantly attempting to speak to us, to reach us. And then the question is going to be whether we're tuned into that frequency or not, and then how to be tuned into that frequency in a context that's frequently pushing you in the other direction, right? There's a lot more we could say about technology and a lot more we could say about economics and all the rest of those things. But for now, maybe it would be good to talk about the Catholic tradition and the global tradition and how these really are two sides of the same coin, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. So, I can just keep going.
Yeah, we wanted to learn more about how you thought that art and literature are intersecting with our understanding of faith in today's world as well. So I think that'd be great to hear more about that.
Yeah, and these are questions that we've also wrestled with quite a bit in the Global Catholic Literature Seminars that the Collegium Institute runs. We're asking whether, in those seminars, we're asking whether there's something to be, something to be found, if not just, not simply in the Western tradition, because the Western tradition, by and large, is shaped by the Catholic tradition already. But where are we finding seeds of the word in literature from around the world that maybe because of various cultural and economic factors and other reasons, right, we were not as aware of those traditions in previous generations. Now, because of the technological reach and just the ease of travel and other various reasons, we're becoming vastly more aware that there is a great tradition that spans the globe and the centuries, right? And recovering some of those resources and seeing where there are confluences with the Western intellectual tradition, seeing where there are connections, where there are differences. These are fascinating questions to grapple with. And we have lots of Catholic writers, even in the 20th century and early 21st, who allow us precisely to cut right to the heart of these issues. For example, Shusaku Endo, we read The Samurai together. He took us back to the early 17th century when Japan and Europe were just coming into contact for the first time. And you had Catholic converts in Japan, and you first had the question, which was live for Endo in his own life, of how do you reconcile, or how do you balance the influence of Japanese culture with the influence of Catholicism, right? What would it be to imagine a Japanese Christ? What is it to imagine a Japanese Christian? Right? Endo is taking us right into the heart of this by taking into the heart of a character who's trained in the samurai tradition. So he is in a lot of ways an avatar of that culture. And then he becomes convinced of the truth of the faith, and he becomes baptized. This is just one example of ways in which, right, there's a fruitful engagement between cultures that might seem to be initially disparate. Another title that we did was Adichie's Purple Hibiscus, where you have a very parallel question for her characters as for Endo's, right? How do we take the soil of this culture, which is rich and beautiful and varied in its own right, and how do we grow a sort of Christian culture in this soil, which might seem in various ways to have its own various tensions. And I think it's instructive to look at the ways in which Catholic culture grew up in the soil of a Greek and Roman and Jewish tradition that in some ways was maybe in tension with some of the values that Christ came to bring. So that sort of that interrelationship was a lot richer, a lot more complicated, and a lot more difficult, challenging, diverse than we tend to realize. But if we, if we just sort of paint over everything in the conversation about classical culture with this sort of simplistic brush, like, oh, what the West was always and everywhere and obviously always Christian. It's like, well, that's not really the case, right? There's a lot more, there's a lot more difficulty there. Lots of things that the Greek and Roman culture valued were precisely values that Christ, and Christian culture came to oppose. Otherwise, we wouldn't have these stories of martyrs martyrdom, of people literally dying to not live their lives the way that the mainstream Roman culture was telling them that they needed to. So there have always been these tensions between the merely human cultures on the natural level and, on the other hand, the values that that Christ calls us to pursue and calls us to engage. So long story short, to talk about the Catholic tradition as global is maybe to recover something, an insight that we always should have been holding on to. And also it's to call people out beyond the the sort of categories of, it's sort of necessary that we have these categories of thinking about our, our intellectual lives, but maybe sometimes the terms in which a debate is framed can be a limit to understanding as well. So to try to create new stories that are engaged in this sort of tension in it within our own globalized and technologized and economically stratified moment, we're doing something that's actually not that different from the people who for centuries and around the world have tried to figure out what it is to tell their own stories in in those contexts, right? But with a Christic orientation.
That is so interesting. And I've thought about that, just kind of thinking about salvation history and the time, the place of where that came to be. And that is so interesting of having that combination of the Greek, Roman, Jewish cultures, kind of be a culmination of where salvation history, God has intended it to be. And I can imagine that in other cultures trying to then evangelize to other cultures and bring the connection between the shared faith that we have and the beliefs that we all know to be true with those cultures and combining it is such an interesting question. And especially the fact that it doesn't mean that the Western culture or where salvation history came to be was ever something that was just the easy choice, because of course Christ was crucified and many martyrs after that still lived in that kind of conflict of their times and of the era. And I'm kind of curious how, as Western culture has evolved too, I don't think that it's evolved in the kind of complications that we have, where there might be fewer martyrs, but at the same time, still that tension between the culture that doesn't perfectly align with Catholicism and with the beliefs that we practice, and still trying to evangelize and get those messages out there. And so I'm kind of curious, how has it been in this time and in this place producing Catholic media? Have there been any challenges or conflicts for you? And how has that kind of been resolved?
In my mind, we're always kind of facing in two directions. We're always looking inward at the culture of the church itself and seeing where there's a need for transformation, seeing where there's a need for grace. And we're also always looking outward at the culture, where are the virtues, where are the good things, where are the things that we can kind of find a point of connection or commonality with somebody who might seem to be, at first glance or in the terms or frames of the debate as given, might seem to be coming from a very different place from us, but actually we might have something that we can connect on. So those are always necessary. I think to turn the critical focus inward and the collaborative focus outward maybe reverses what's instinctive for us as human beings, but I think is the necessary disposition, maybe just for the Christian life, right? To look at where do I need to transform, makes it, I guess, in a certain way more possible to think about where can I connect with you who disagree with me. So I think that the challenge always begins interiorly, right? Whatever the practical challenges are as you move through the the everyday difficulties of, how do I get this book in the, or how do I get this issue of the journal Right, in the best state that I can get it into. The bigger picture questions are the ones that I guess I stay awake at night thinking about, right? Practical difficulties always have a solution, but spiritual ones are you're always having to plead for the grace to meet those. And without God building the house, the laborers build in vain, right? So.
Definitely. I think, especially in like our day and age with media, I think it's just a very difficult field to go in because I think everything is very politicized and polarized. And I was just wondering, have you encountered any challenges in producing Catholic media? Especially the faith aspect, I can imagine, adds another element that might complicate and make the discourse even harder. So I was just wondering, how do you mitigate those effects, and what has been your experience in that?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. I think I've been pleasantly surprised to see more receptivity in the mainstream culture to well-raised questions of faith. I think the way that you mitigate the kind of heat that you're talking about in the polarization and politicization of things is that you just kind of leapfrog over those kinds of stages of the debate. You kind of if you look too deeply into right this sort of this whirlpool of recrimination and sort of blame that you just kind of get drawn into it and there's no real benefit to that, right? Don't read the comments, maybe is what I'm trying to say. there's a need to kind of, and again, I say leapfrog over as if that were a thing that you could do, where probably the more effective metaphor is you're hang gliding over it, right? You're hanging on to something that the wind is carrying you and you just are trying to get where you're going. And the only thing you have to do is not let go. I admire very much. I'm happy to be at Word on Fire because I admire very much the way that the Bishop Barron has sort of successfully hang glided over quite a number of attempts to sort of drag the discourse down into various kinds of recrimination, blame, etc., various ways of trying to say that this is really this and that's really that. There's a recognition here, I think, that a lot of those negative forms of discourse that we encounter are reductive and reductive on purpose. Their purpose is not to establish truth. Their purpose is to shut down debate, right? And shut down not only debate, as if debate were kind of the height of what we can manage as a human species in terms of intellectual engagement. But debate is for the sake of something. Debate is for the sake of truth. And very often, attempts to shut down debate and discourse to say there's no debate on such and such a question, or to say, prima facie, you have to believe X, Y, and Z, or there won't be, you won't be allowed to be part of the conversation at all. Precisely those kinds of rhetorical strategies that we find online quite a bit are not ordered to truth at all, but they're ordered to sort of a discourse as expression of the will to power, in an attempt to dominate. If people see that everywhere, as many people online do see that everywhere, it might be because they themselves are attempting to use conversation as a means to impose power rather than a conversation as a means to arrive at truth together, right? So it's why I have a very deep opposition to all of the kinds of things that you sometimes encounter in literary studies. This is probably why I didn't do a PhD in English, why I went the literary writing route instead. Because if you when people tell you who they are, believe them, right? If they tell you that they believe that all conversation is just an expression of a force, run, just run, run out of that room, run out of that setting. That's not humane in any way, right? And I don't care who you are, if you're a believer or not.
Absolutely. And
yeah.
And I'm so curious because I imagine that a lot of your life has been wrapped up in these complications and also in exploring these truths. And so as this is something that not just that you can think about on a side of doing your career, but since this is such a large part of something that you're involved in doing every day, mm-hmm. I kind of wonder how is being part of Catholic media and production influenced your faith journey?
For me, it's been, I think, yeah, that again is a really interesting and a worthwhile a question. It's funny because I don't know if I ever really perceived there to be another path for me as an individual. And I think just because I was so immersed so early in Catholic culture, right. I think, for someone who maybe is standing more on the outside and has the option to go, go into Catholic media or go into some other form, in a way that, you might evaluate the sort of cost benefit and say, like, I can do more good here than I can do there, something like this. For me, it has been profoundly strengthening to my ability to continue believing, to find that there's so many intelligent, so many people of goodwill who mutually care about these kinds of questions with me, and who are willing to form a community around these kinds of questions. So for me, it's been a tremendously supportive context, and I hope mutually so. The sense that I have, or the desire that I have, is to discern how I can best serve with the talents and gifts that God has given to me. So, the desire is always in that direction. The thing that I'm finding is that as I've asked that question, I've also just been tremendously well served by others who are asking the same thing. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I can imagine that grappling with these really big questions definitely will form your faith life as well. And it definitely leads to a lot of routes for prayer and contemplation, which I think is wonderful. I guess sort of to lead us off today, we were just wondering, with the launch of Word on Fire, what is your vision for its role in contemporary Catholic discourse?
My hope is that we can spark conversations that go beyond the sort of reductive, flattening frames of, again, the contemporary discourse is so shaped by internet culture. People talk about the internet novel even as a phenomenon that's taking place now. Increasingly, you have people unable to see reality outside of these kind of reductive and to some extent spurious category belongings that, and labeling habits of mind, taxonomizations that kind of break everything down into this very controllable and manipulable and frankly dead kind of schematic. I am hoping that by producing texts that are beautiful, that are true, that are good, that are well formed, that are well thought through, and that are importantly engaged with situations and in contexts that don't respond easily to that kind of attempt to label and characterize and contextualize things out of existence, that by telling stories that resist those kinds of paradigms, we can get people having conversations about experience as we find it, and again, reality as it really is, and not as we try to construct it. In a way that's, I guess, more, for me, that's definitely formed in part by David Foster Wallace's idea of the new sincerity, right? The après-garde as opposed to the avant-garde, right? Turning to some degree to the past, but not merely for the sake of turning to the past, also for the sake of walking forward and, telling stories in a way that's authentic and that connects people rather than dividing them.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It was wonderful to hear about how your work has influenced your faith journey and what this looks like to be in Catholic media and to grow through that. It has been such a pleasure. And that is the Wheel Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies. It's been a joy.
You've been listening to The Wheel, a Collegium Institute podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes. And to stay up to date on upcoming events and programming, visit collegiuminstitute.org.